Welcome to another exciting episode of CTOs at Work today. So today, I have a pleasure of introducing our esteemed guest, Mr. Daniel Pickett, who joined us from Freight Waves, where he serves as the Chief Technology Officer. With over 20 plus years of experience in logistics, supply chain, and various other industries, Daniel is at the forefront of driving digital transformation at really, really large scale. And at Freight Waves, he's revolutionizing freight forwarding processes and fostering collaboration through innovative technology solutions. And prior to joining Freight Waves, Daniel has held various leadership positions in renowned technology companies where he is successfully led cross-functional team and delivered digital transformation project. And he is known for his strategic mindset, ability to navigate the complex challenges, and his commitment to leveraging technology to drive the business growth. He's truly a techno business leader. And so get ready to gain valuable insight as we chat with Daniel about logistic digital transformation, maybe ChatGPT and other exciting development happening around the Freight Waves. So without further delay, let's jump right into it with conversation with Mr. Daniel Pickett, CTO at Freight Waves. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you for having me and for that effusive introduction. I'd love to meet the luminary you were talking about there.
It's all your humbleness, Daniel. So, Daniel, tell us about your career journey. What was it? How you reached at this place? And what was
your journey? So, as early as, when I was in grade school, had an interest in computers early, started kind of dabbling around in programming and, Microsoft Access databases and, learning to do macros and then into things like C++ and web development. And so ultimately decided to go to study computer science. And then did what you do when you get out with a computer science degree, became a developer. And, I've just always enjoyed kind of following the technology and watching just how, we can solve real world business problems. We can make things more efficient. We can make, we can make people's time much more valuable. And, never really went deep into the, I'm going to build technology for technology's sake. I've always been I want to understand the problem. I want to understand the user and I want to build a solution that meets their needs. And so started my career at the Vanguard Group and we're basically building websites for your stock and mutual fund and bonds and, kind of your 401k portfolio. And then worked in the financial services industry for probably 15, maybe between 10 and 15 years, taking on additional responsibilities, kind of leading development teams. And then really getting into kind of a data science and the applied, analytical techniques in that capital markets and investment space. And so between those two, really became fascinated with data and software and kind of how to work together with them. So an opportunity came up to lead the data science team at Freight Waves. And ultimately what I saw in supply chain is, back in 2017, before the pandemic, is that the way supply chain works is kind of the way that, the stock and bond markets used to work in the 1950s or 1980s. There's massive information disadvantage. The brokers have far more information than either the shipper or the actual carrier. There's not really great data products out there to help people, kind of understand, what is capacity, what does supply and demand look like in a particular city? Because every city, some have too many trucks, some have not enough trucks. Some ports, are having massively long lines like LA and Long Beach was through the pandemic. And then there's others that have a little bit of capacity. And I think we've seen some of those shifts happen. We've seen it in the data. We've heard about it anecdotally. And so, really my career it certainly has not been a plan, but to get to where I am now, but it's always been kind of running towards what's interesting, interesting problems that we think data and technology can help solve. And so that is what got me from a guy in my parents' house, pecking away at Excel macros to a chief technology officer now.
That's quite interesting. And very interestingly, you talk about, you know, pre-pandemic logistic industry and where it is reached now. So in just like 2-3 years, it travels seems like a lot.
Well, you know, logistics and supply chain is kind of one of those things that, you know, it's like your electricity or your garage door opener. You don't notice it until it breaks. And then you go, what is going on? This is very frustrating when this service that I've taken for granted is not working as well as it used to. So certainly, you know, when you said, oh, I do supply chain, data and technology, you know, in 2019 and before, people just went to sleep. They're like, okay, I'm done. I don't want to hear about it. You know, and then, you know, mid 2020, if you said that, people said, oh, really? Wow. Yeah. Tell me about the supply chain issues. I'm building a deck and I can't get lumber, or I'm, you know, whatever. I need a new car. Mine broke down and, you know, there are no computer chips and you can't get a car. And so it certainly highlighted to people like supply chain is really, really, really important. And we sort of take all these things for granted because we're used to ordering on Amazon. I click the tracking link. I say, oh, it's left Memphis. It's gone to Nashville. It's on a truck to Chattanooga. It'll be here tomorrow. And you know, we sort of think that logistics and supply chain and moving physical goods around the world is really well organized. You peel back the layers in the onion, it is a wild, wild diaspora of technologies and service providers and intermediaries. And certainly international transit brings its own challenges. And so, you know, I think people probably didn't realize that. They just seen, you know, it's like the little tracker. Oh, it's moving to here. It'll expected delivery. It'll be here, you know, at 2 p.m. tomorrow. And so people realize, oh, wow, maybe things are not so simple. And, you know, when you have a global event like the coronavirus, you know, it certainly puts international systems under strain. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great realization for all the companies around. In fact, I can this correlate very well. Last year, I was talking to, I was doing consulting for one of the freight forwarders. They are very big known freight forwarder here in India. And one of a day, like DHL has came up with one of their guidelines. Oh, we want to integrate EDI. Without EDI, we don't gonna entertain anything, no manual spreadsheet, nothing. And it was a nightmare for those guys. Seriously, a big nightmare. Yeah. And it was
EDI is one of those technologies that it was a really great idea, and then we didn't follow through on. You know, we didn't do a great job of as an industry really managing standards and saying, you know, this is going to be the standard. You know, the reason that we can communicate remotely like we're doing now is there are standards bodies that rigorously, you know, vet any changes to the way that, you know, TCP/IP works, the way that, you know, HTML works and the web works and all those communication protocols. That they're pretty rigorously documented and adhered to and enforced. You know, and I think EDI, you kind of had everybody doing their own sort of thing, and it has become very difficult. It's one of those things where I tell people just hire an expert. Just hire an expert. They're out there. It can be a mess. I hate to hear that you had to deal with that problem because it can be a mess.
Yeah. So just like in US, I have seen especially for law firms and legal industry, there is a standard called YGC standard. You got the claim. That is an industry-wide standard every law firm has to follow. Do we have something similar for the logistic space, or something like is cooking up and regulations are being done in that direction?
You know, I mean, you mentioned EDI. EDI is the closest thing there is to a standard, truly. Yes. And it's, you know, a well-defined but poorly enforced standard. So otherwise, you know, I see a lot of companies moving from EDI to APIs, which is, you know, it is fine. They kind of run on the more modern tech stacks. You know, most developers now can read a JSON document. They know what to do with it. They can troubleshoot that really well. So, you know, the move to APIs is great, but there's been virtually no standardization in the move from EDI to API. And so, you know, every pairwise combination, you know, tends to be a custom development effort, which is just, it's massively wasteful. You know, now it protects the companies that, you know, have a large library of, you know, hey, I've worked with Target before. I've worked with Anheuser-Busch before. If you sign on with me, I've already got a template ready that can translate your API to their API.
Yeah.
And so I do see a lot of companies in the space, you know, kind of doing that. But, you know, I like standards. I like openness. And so so I think, it you know, we're kind of making some of the same mistakes that are going to allow vendor lock-in with you know, communication about supply chain logistics. But, you know, you also, what you didn't have in the past is you didn't have these massive, you know, enterprise level, well-funded, you know, new software companies that, you know, they are a software company, not a trucking company or a shipping company or a brokerage who also has to do software. And so, you know, I think you've seen kind of private companies rush into the void left by a lack of a standard. And certainly there's more freight technology available today. It's unreal the just bloom that has happened in freight technology companies over the last, I'd call it 5 years or so. You know, financial tech, the fintech revolution happened starting maybe 15 years ago to about 5 years ago. And now, and you've got all these great technologies. It's easy to send money around, whether that be by, you know, Venmo or Cash App or PayPal, or if you're using crypto to send money, you know, internationally, there's some places where crypto works well. But yeah, really in freight and supply chain, that sort of bloom in investment dollars and new technology companies started maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, and there's some really great solutions out there. And I think we see the companies that are using technology and using data, they're a lot more efficient. And so now in kind of the current economic softness we've seen, they're a lot more resilient than the companies that said, we've been doing it this way for 50 years and we're, you know, we don't need any help. So. You know, it's as always, those who pay attention to kind of current trends and you know, are aware of developing technologies, you know, are probably going to be better suited for the business climate in the long term.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Yeah. And especially I have seen a lot of advancement is happening, innovation is happening on the sustainability side as well. So, for example, the companies like who are into maritime space, they do a lot of sustainability innovation. I met with one of the company. They specialize into sustainability. They offer like 10%. They run it like 10% initiatives around. So this is great. Like a lot of innovation is happening around.
So yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think there's kind of two categories of what I see around kind of the you know, environmental. I mean, first of all, you're right. Supply chain produces a ton of carbon emissions. You know, the science is very, very clear. I'm a data guy. The science is very clear. Increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing the average temperature over a long term to rise. And so, you know, there's certainly been, you know, government mandates that have done that. And you know, right now there's sort of a contention about the can we get, you know, diesel trucks to zero emission by 2030? Not a chance. There is not a chance. But you know, as you slowly tighten the standards, or you apply an average over the whole fleet, then maybe it can. You know, we can get there eventually. But yeah, you know, the other thing. So government regulation is a big one. In 2020, the year we had the pandemic, all the big maritime ships had to get off of this really dirty bunker fuel, and so a lot of them converted to diesel. You know, and some have other powertrains, but generally that's been one of the things that's caused diesel prices go up, which has made it harder on trucking, because maritime is buying diesel instead of that dirty, cheap bunker fuel now. And, you know, and high diesel sort of is another catalyst for trucking companies or, you know, anybody who's buying diesel to say, maybe there's alternative powertrains out there, whether that be, you know, natural gas or electric or some, you know, some form of hydrogen powered. And so, you know, I think what we haven't seen a lot of yet is just a demand that says, I am willing to pay more to have, you know, a low carbon option. There's a few companies out there that do that, you know, where corporate social responsibility, environmental concerns are really top of mind for them, and it's part of their brand. But you know, I think we generally still see most companies wanting to be environmental when it saves them money, wanting to be environmentally friendly when it reduces cost. And so, you know, I think government regulation will probably have to pick up the slack where there is not an obvious cost savings today. And, you know, we see various kind of countries and municipalities throughout the world doing that, you know, some in the form of just, here's a regulation, you have to meet it, do it. And some in the form of, you know, hey, we're going to provide incentives, we're going to, you know, provide additional research dollars to anybody who's looking at these alternative powertrains. And so, you know, I think both innovation and cost saving, that also reduces carbon emission, that's going to be one piece of the puzzle, but government's going to have a big role to play also.
Yeah, I completely agree. Government has a big, big role to play here. And they have to simplify the framework so that each and every company can adopt at a wider scale. Yeah, I completely agree with that. So for my listeners, Daniel, as they are coming from various different industries, right? The audience who listen to this podcast. So for them, can you explain like what exactly your product or technology does and why focus on technology is important for your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are at our core, we are a software and data company. We collect data from hundreds of different sources about the physical movement of goods all over the world. And so that's moves on ships, it moves on airplanes, it moves on trains, it moves on trucks. And so we collect data on all of those and then, you know, kind of combine that data, try to do forecasting, break it down into kind of regional indices and data points, and then ultimately we sell that back to people who participate in the supply chain. So whether you're, you know, manufacturing phones, you know, in now in India, I see a lot of phone production moving your direction, or whether you're, you know, canning soda in Atlanta, you know, you've got to participate in that. And then there's the people who actually own the ships and the vessels, and then like you said, you work with a broker. The intermediaries who help arrange all that, you know, those people need data to make better decisions. And that's what we do. We go out and gather all of these disparate data points, kind of put them together in a nice format. And then also we have media content that kind of interprets that data and helps people understand what they're seeing. So there's a data and there's an education and media component. And ultimately what we're trying to do is help our customers make smarter decisions, whether that be to increase your revenue or decrease your expense. There's not a third way to improve your business. You know, since I've checked, so that's what we do.
Okay, that's great. So you have your products, a templatized visualization product, which companies can consume.
Exactly. And so, you know, ultimately, what we want our customers to do is make better decisions. And so, our product is data. And some people consume that through our UI, which you mentioned is a really great visualization tool. Some just consume bulk data through APIs. Some consume it through integrations we have into other software providers. You know, I think everybody has screen fatigue now. I'm talking to you here, and I probably should have closed some of the hundreds of tabs I have open.
That's the same thing. That's the same thing going on my mind as well right now. I also have a hundred of screens open now.
I've gotten good at turning off the other monitors when I'm having a meeting with one person. But some of our customers say, "Look, I love your product, love your data, but I just can't handle another screen, another monitor." And so we work with kind of their software providers where they're in there doing their daily arranging, you know, for transportation or loads or, you know, matching drivers to loads. And then they can see our rate data and volume data and kind of capacity insights there as well. So, ultimately, we as a technology and data company, we've got to meet the customer where they are. And you know, early in our life, our user interface, our visualization tool was the only option. And, you know, we found some success there. But, in the early stage of growing a company, you are just trying everything to see what will the customer pay for and you know, stay and renew, and what will make this free trial convert to a paying customer. And then, you know, you sort of hit this phase where it's like, I have customers and I have to, you know, now we have to listen to them. And so we have three different customer advisory boards for kind of the different sectors. And we, you know, listen to them very seriously. We rigorously, every single sales call, every single customer call is recorded. and translate a natural language, translate a text there. And so we can, we can observe what's effective, what's not. We can look for trends. We collect user behavior both on the API and on the UI. And so, now we're kind of in that phase of, we still want to dream big and come up with new things, but listening to customers really is when you start to find that product market fit and you go, okay, now my sales guys know how to sell. My customer success people know how to kind of monitor usage and figure out who might be at risk of churn. And our software and data teams, they listen to those calls. They go to the conferences. They listen to our media and the webinars that we put on and the podcast. And those things really do kind of help them have context for the industry. So it's pretty great to be, obviously there's kind of some economic softness and it's hitting transportation particularly hard, but it is kind of rewarding to see the company get to a phase where, you can take customer feedback, you can implement that in the product, and then you can kind of see the instant, whether it's you have upsells or, your growth accelerates or churn goes down, whatever it is. That's a really rewarding thing as a software developer to see, hey, the things we're working on are making an impact for the business and for our customers ultimately.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So one question, Daniel, on this thought, as you mentioned, a very interesting and classical scenario, how companies build their product, right? At the initial stages, every entrepreneur, right, when they're starting up, they take all the requests and start like building up a product, right? It's like, you have a chef in the kitchen and whatever, spices is coming up on his hand, he's picking up and then cooking up.
Yeah.
So what is your advice for new generation entrepreneurs or new CTOs who are just getting into and building new products completely from the grounds up? What sort of thinking they should adopt? What sort of processes they should need to get to make their product really successful from the day one?
Yeah, I think early in any company or venture's life, it's going to be founder driven. It has to be because at some point there is one employee. It's the founder who's either, lost their job or decided to just take a risk, or in most cases, what I see now is founders are, they're moonlighting, so they're taking their nights and weekends and they've got an idea and they just start building a prototype. And so I love that model. It's certainly the safest. If you're not independently wealthy, you can just, go without a job for a few years. It's certainly a safe model that almost anyone who has some skill can approach. And so, I think at first, like you said, very founder driven, you've got to take your experience and say, here's the product I wish I had in my old job or whatever your driving vision is. And I think the mistake that we made a little bit at FreightWaves, but we corrected quickly. And then I see a lot of others making is they don't start collecting, usage data, and they don't start collecting user feedback early enough. And I think you have to take that feedback in. Now, also, there's the old Henry Ford adage, well, if I asked customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. And so, I think there's collect the data, collect the customer feedback, but also, ask why five times. Ask, why do you want, why do you want this to be blue instead of red? Because I have, 10% of users are colorblind. Oh, okay, that makes sense. And so, really asking why and driving down to the need, not just the request, is a really important thing when you talk to customers. And then paying attention to, does what customers say happen, does it actually show up in data? Because in many cases, customers will tell you things that the data kind of disagrees with. And so, I would say that's the three legs of the stool, is kind of customer usage, voice of customer. And then, those of us who have been in the industry and have been talking to customers and asking questions and studying problems, asking why and going, what's the new thing? What is the next way we push the envelope? Once you kind of get those three legs of your stool figured out, then really I think that's when the magic starts to happen. And that's when you can find product market fit and you can start focusing on growth instead of growth hacking, where it's just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah. Yeah. One common question, Daniel, I see a lot of CTOs have in their mind when they build any new product or they think about revamping their own technology. What technology is tech you choose? So what's your advice on that?
You know, I think it is changing stacks once you have momentum is really hard. And it does tend to cause you, you know, to stop focusing on building new things that customers will buy and start focusing on, crap, I've got to fix my infrastructure. You know, there's going to be tech debt. That's going to be a normal part of any growing enterprise. And we've certainly felt our share of it at FreightWaves is the need to do some refactoring and kind of slow down so that we can speed up in the future. You know, I would say that the temptation for founders is to just go with what they know. You know, and I think I'm a prime example. We, you know, my career started taking off. I really got into leadership. And you know, when you get into leadership, you don't get to do as much coding. You don't get to do as much. And yes. So, you know, those skills atrophied a little bit. And so, you know, for me, it was really tempting to say, well, you know, back when I was running my own development company, we used a LAMP stack. Because that's, you know, it's a Linux, that's Apache, that's MySQL and PHP. That's what we're building. And fortunately, we did not do that. You know, we went with the, you know, we really sort of looked into some of the kind of the cloud native technologies and looked at some of the modern sort of cloud databases that are out there and said, you know, we don't want to be on-prem. We will, you know, we'll retrain ourselves, the early team, and then we will hire, you know, for people that kind of know this modern cloud stack, simply because it's, you know, a giant enterprise, you know, thousands of employees, they might be able to have a hybrid on-prem and cloud strategy that's more cost-effective. You're trying to solve a business problem. You're not trying to set up servers and plug them in and worry about internet redundancy and power redundancy. And, you know, that's just not, that's not capital efficient for you. So I would say, you know, definitely look at what's out there and what's available, because, you know, it's tempting to say, well, I'll just hire smart people and they can build things. I don't want to buy this expensive tool. There really are tool sets out there, you know, that can pay for themselves in terms of, you know, salary and headcount, you know, savings. And so, you know, I think about your data, think about kind of your front end and stack. And then the other thing to look at is, look at the labor pool, because, you know, that there's, you know, there's a couple front end technology you can use. There's a couple back end technologies you can use. And, you know, here's a great example. Snowflake and Firebolt compete, do the same thing. They're both cloud databases. They argue over who's better. But when I try to find a candidate, I can find thousands of people who have worked in Snowflake. They know how to administer it. They know how to query it. They know how to run it. Firebolt is newer. It's hard to find labor there. So I think you've got to consider, you know, total cost of ownership, including labor. You've got to consider availability of labor. And then you've got to consider, you know, sort of all the other intangibles of, you know, am I going to have to hire a whole infrastructure team if I have this on-prem? Am I going to have to think about power and internet? Am I going to, you know, my Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP stack can support 100 users at a time. What if I have 100,000 users at a time? Or I have people starting to hit my APIs and really pound my database and my API stack. Do I have that scalability? And so, you know, there's certainly a lot of considerations. And I think it's important to not box yourself in, not to let any of your multiple components become too tightly coupled. You know, that's one thing that having a good architecture brain on your tech team early will help you do is, if the database needs a change, it shouldn't affect the front end. And ideally, if it doesn't even affect kind of your APIs and your middle tier, that's even better too. And so, you know, thinking about decoupling all these different things from each other so that when you have to switch a piece out for something more scalable, you don't have to switch out the whole tech stack.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So yeah, it's, that was a lot of steps to remember there, but, you know, it's, I would just say try to think long term and try to think about total costs, both in people and in software licensing dollars.
Yeah, I think that's a great piece of advice, Daniel. Because what I have seen when people make these technology decisions, especially, you know, when somebody who is getting just out of the technology role or senior developer role or tech lead role and going into a leadership role, they forget the aspect of talent availability, which is very, very crucial, because that's strategic decision and that is very critical in driving growth and scalability. Yeah,
for sure. The other thing that I would say for technology leaders is thinking about the total cost and always managing to that cost of both software licensing as well as, you know, your cloud infrastructure costs and your salary costs. As a technology leader, it can earn you a lot of goodwill with your CFO. And, our CFO at FreightWaves and I have a great relationship and a lot of trust. And a lot of that is because I try to learn his language and his, you know, pain points. And he tries to learn mine too, in terms of, you know, because he's seen that we have cost discipline. When I have to go to our CFO and our chief revenue officer and our head of product and say, all right, guys, I need us to release fewer features for the next 2 quarters because we've got to move, you know, we've got to change out our database or we've got to, you know, whatever. We're changing the tech stack on how we're doing trucking rates. Then, because we've sort of shown a willingness to kind of have grit and deliver for them before and do it in a financially responsible way, then they have a little bit more willingness to say, you know, okay, I trust that if we deliver fewer features in the next quarter or two, that these improvements you make are going to make us more efficient, and either our infrastructure costs is going to go down, or our velocity of kind of sprint deliverables is going to go up after that period of kind of retooling. And so there's a lot of benefits to kind of, I'd say for a leader, having those relationships, having an understanding of the financials is important. I know it's not what we're natively trained in, but it is important for you to understand as a technology leader. And then just understanding the key performance indicators of your business, because that's, you know, you as a leader, you have to help steer the ship, not just, you know, replace rotten boards and tend the sails. So I think it's an exciting challenge. I've enjoyed it. But I've also have had some brilliant developers or even brilliant, you know, managers of development teams who, when you say, hey, I need you to kind of start learning about the financials, I need you to go, you know, kind of spend less of your time in the code and more of your time, you know, building your network on the, with our people in sales and customer service and finance and product. And, there's some really capable people that say, you know what, I want to stay in the code, and that's okay. So as you kind of help people build a career path, really understanding them and you know, letting them know, well, you know, let's go talk to that person, see if that's what kind of job you want. And you know, a lot of them say, well, I want to be a CTO one day. What's it like? Well, you don't do any code. You do a lot of budgets. you make a lot of PowerPoints. You have a lot of meetings. And they go, you know what? I don't think I want to do that. and so people development and being transparent and kind of helping people get where they want to go is another really important part of being a technology leader. We've certainly seen, especially, it seems like every successive generation expects to spend less and less time in a job, and therefore will have more employers on their resume as they go. As a leader, it's important to kind of help them think about that next step and when it's right to take. And, we'll always, with a high performing employee, we will always try to find a growth path for them within our company. But we've had some high performing employees who, they wanted to try something different in a different sector and, you know, maybe had spent several years here and aren't learning as much as they were when they first started. And we've kind of, told those people, thank you for everything you've done for us. And we're excited. And if the grass is not greener, please come back. So I think people is the last major leg of technology leadership, is really getting to know them. And there's this old reputation that technology and data folks have for being introverts and reclusive. I don't think that's entirely accurate. There are certainly introverts and extroverts, but most people they if you build that relationship of trust, they do want to talk about where they want to go and what they want to do next. And maybe that's, hey, I I like what I do, but I coach all my kids' soccer teams. And, you know, on the weekends, my spouse works nights and weekends. And I just, you know, I can be here for this hour, and I don't need to burn the midnight oil, but I don't need, you know, to get promoted rapidly either. And so, you know, really getting to know everybody and kind of understanding where they are and what it is that they expect to get from you, you know, it is a really important part of being a leader. So you got to get good at that.
That's quite insightful. That's great. So as we are talking about, Daniel, about technology, and today there is a notion, technology conversation feels incomplete if you don't talk about ChatGPT or AI.
Of course you have to.
So what's your thoughts, you know, and what do you see impact, maybe positive or maybe negative, with ChatGPT or any form of AI tool chain coming into your industry, beyond your industries?
Yeah. You know, I think AI, you know, where we are today, it is really good at certain things. But I think for people who've not actually tried to build a machine learning model or a large language model or a time series prediction model, it can fool us into thinking it's doing something that it's not. ChatGPT is really, really great at plagiarism, but it's plagiarism, you know? And so, but because it's so good at plagiarism, we think that it's having original thought, and it's not. It's just read a massive corpus of text. That doesn't mean it's useless. That means, you know, caveat emptor, buyer beware. What you're buying, it has a very specific skill set. It does not have general intelligence. So, you know, I think large language models specifically, we've been using those for quite some time. You know, we had Kite, and now there's GitHub Copilot, you know, which are doing code completion and even, you know, I want to write a for loop. Boom, there it is. You're done. And so, you know, that's existed for quite, for several years anyway. ChatGPT certainly it's interesting. It's entertaining. It's gotten a lot of headlines. And on the media and the content side of the business, we certainly use it to build out stubs or to, you know, say, hey, what caption am I going to give this this YouTube video that's going to get the highest number of views? And it will, you know, again, it's doing plagiarism. It will read the millions of blog posts on how to increase your engagement with a YouTube video and suggest, hey, why don't you give it this caption after it reads the, you know, the whole text of the video. And, you know, it works. It is effective, but effectively it is really good at plagiarism. and so, you know, as long as you know that and you let people proofread, you know, and you make sure that people are proofreading, because it will make up facts. Our data product is called Sonar. And so one of our sales guys said, you know, ChatGPT, tell me about Sonar. Well, of course, it had scraped all of our marketing copy. And it said, and Sonar is an acronym that stands for Supply Organization. And I can't remember what all. and they're like, that's so cool. I didn't know it was an acronym. And I said, it's not. It's not. ChatGPT just made that up because it sounded credible. And so, you know, I think it definitely can do productivity. I think the reports right now of where the technology is today, the reports that, oh, it's going to lead to unemployment, jobs are going to go away, maybe a little bit overblown. Because, you know, I think what it ultimately does is it helps you. It's like a template. It helps you with, you know, 80% of the total text or the code, but that's only 20% of the time. That last 20% of integrating and getting all the pieces together and making sure, fact checking, you know, that piece is very, very time consuming, even though it's a small number of words. You know, something I've always said is, you know, So some managers, software developers want to say, well, you know, you didn't type as many lines of code, or you had 10 defects per million lines of code instead of, you know, one defect per million lines of code. They tried to Six Sigma software development. I said, I think we're thinking about this all wrong, guys. You know, that we don't produce code, you know, at a steady rate. Like 80% of the time in software development is trying to just understand the problem well enough to code to it. 20% of the time is coding. And so, the fact that it can generate 80% of your code for you or 80% of a news article for you, that's great. And it does save you time. It can't do the hard part yet. And maybe someday it will. But generally, where we are with large language models is we are plagiarizing prior content to produce what is the most likely next word that's going to satisfy the user. That's not original thought. That's a really good plagiarism.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. And as you mentioned about, jobs, right? Last week, I attended a conference where Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI, he visited India, and there was a huge conference. So I went there in that conference, and he talked about the job security. So he talked about there would not going to be any job constraint because the jobs will get replaced. You're doing something, it will get replaced with something else, and will increase a lot of productivity and a lot of new jobs will be coming out in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people, every time we have a time-saving invention, whether it be the Industrial Revolution or, I'll give you one from supply chain. In the 1700s, 1800s, not all of the railroads in America had the same width of their rails. So you would get to Kansas City and they'd have to unload everything off this train and put it on a train that had more narrow gauge rails to take it further west. When we said, hey, let's standardize rail sizes, everybody said, no. Oh, my gosh, that'll make competition. It'll drive our rates down. It'll kill jobs. What about the guys who move the freight from the, from the 4-foot wide track to the 3-foot 9-inch wide track? That guy's job will go away. And ultimately what happened is it reduced the cost of moving things by rail. This is going to reduce the cost of building things in software. So you know what's going to happen? We're going to go, wow, there's even more problems we can solve with software. We're going to need more developers. And so it's like saying Microsoft Excel or Lotus 1-2-3 was going to kill the profession of accounting. It didn't. In fact, they're now they're doing accounting and they're auditing the accounting and now they're auditing, our standards of controls for SOC 2. It certainly makes each individual more efficient. But as that per unit cost comes down, we tend to say, hey, I want more units, when the per unit cost goes down. And so, I think, could there be displacement? A little bit. But for the most part, I think productivity tools are a good thing.
Yeah. And especially as we see in the current time where we have a lot of backlog with each and every organization. You talk to any company, they have hiring pipelines, they are not finding right talent, a lot of backlog is there. I think this productivity can boost that up.
Absolutely. If people are more productive and the cost per unit of building software comes down, we're going to start solving, new problems that we hadn't thought of, or that we thought is just too expensive. And as labor gets more expensive, it becomes even more tempting to solve those challenges. Look at what's happening in fast food. I don't know if it's happening in India, but, here in the U.S., the number of people who stand at a counter and place their order with a human being is shrinking. I mean, we're not calling in to place an order. We're not going to the counter and placing an order. We're doing it on our phone or in some cases on a touch screen in the, inside of a fast service restaurant. And so, that's a problem that we would have said, my God, engineers are going to have to spend years perfecting this app and the back end and the uptime and the reliability. And how do we handle exceptions? But then when the cost of, labor keeps going up and, just because of scarcity or because of minimum wages and the cost of software keeps coming down because of productivity tools like, code completion or templates out there, and all the libraries you have now for interpreted languages like Python or R or whatever, then really it opens up new problems to software. And that's a good thing. I think people are not going to this because the old option's not available. People are not going to ordering via app and touchscreen because the old option went away. they're going to it because it is more convenient. You know, my food is ready faster. I don't have to exchange cash or card at the window. It's already paid for by my app. You know, it really does create a better user experience. And you know, as the cost of software comes down, we're going to find new places to put software. Don't you worry.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's quite insightful. Now, this is a good segue to my another question. So considering the economic ups and downs, particularly the impact of a pandemic, how you suggest staying like resilient in the tech career? What sort of strategies or one can follow, you know, in terms of these market fluctuations and maintaining career resiliency in all of these kind of circumstances?
Yeah, you know, technology is, I don't know, it's the only industry I've really worked in. So maybe other industries are this way, but it feels like in technology, things change so fast that it's really hard to, you know, to keep up and to kind of keep your skills fresh. You know, one of my best friends is a surgeon. The way he performs that surgery, it hasn't changed in 20 years. I'm on probably the, you know, the 12th, you know, database technology or language I've had to learn at this point. And so, you know, I think it does change. And what you really have to do is, you know, you have to invest that time in yourself to say, you know, I am going to, you know, just spend with an hour a week, or you take you take a week or a couple of days a month, a week a year, a couple of days a month. And you've got to, you know, just experiment with something new that sounds interesting, or do side passion projects. You know, if you're really lucky, then maybe there's a way to kind of explore new tech at work. You know, we certainly, as we're trying new ideas at FreightWaves, we tend to do like pilot projects, you know, fail fast. We're going to do it in the lab. And so when we do those sort of like pilot, you know, sort of learning projects, that's where we'll kind of encourage people to explore something new. That's not the current tech stack. You know, that's, you know, you want to try building out an API endpoint in Golang, do it. You know, let's do this as a lab project while we kind of test usability and UX and features and is this data useful? And then from there we can, you know, decide, hey, should this weave its way into our mainstream tech stack or fun experiment? We're going back to home base when we build this product for real. And so, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it. I think it is a good thing for technology leaders to, you know, always be thinking about your people and making sure you're giving them the time and the budget to go learn. Because if you don't, somebody else will. And so, you know, so it is important as a leader to do that. But it's important to kind of take responsibility for your own career as well. And to say, you know, for me lately, it's been, hey, I've got to read. I've been doing a lot of reading about teams that have burnout, about, you know, how do you keep yourself fresh? What do you do when you're a growth stage company and you need to, you know, unlock additional TAM? How should you run effective, you know, software development organizations? And so those are the kind of things that now for my professional development, I have to do is a lot of reading and webinars and listening to podcasts like yours. You know, those are the things that I try to do to kind of keep my skills cutting edge. Not as much new programming language anymore, but, you know, it is really important to invest in yourself. And if you're a leader, make sure you're investing in your people and directing them to invest in themselves.
That's great learning. Absolutely. Absolutely. So now this, leads to the organization culture aspect, because this is something that organization has to put into the DNAs of, because I've seen various different kind of organization, you know, one kind of organization who are very, very transactional in nature. They just throw up the things, get done. There are a few organization which is more of a pretty good relationship with the employee. They encourage, empower. And there are other kind of, you know, completely sales-driven organization as well, where everybody is selling something, even their CTOs, even their developers selling something. So
yeah,
in terms of organization culture, so what is your organization culture and what structures or processes you follow, which you see, you know, is really giving you good results?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so we're a startup that has been growing extremely fast. And so over 6 years, I've seen our culture change two or three times. And that makes sense. You know, there's a different culture when, you know, we've got a limited amount of money. The company's going to be bankrupt if we don't succeed. You know, that is one type of frantic culture. And that may be kind of the, like you said, everybody has a job to sell. And you're kind of a small incumbent challenging the status quo, whether that be another company in the industry or whether that just be, you know, inaction and underinvestment in technology, which, you know, I would say I see both of those as competitors. Once you sort of have a book of business and you have customers, you know, then sort of you don't have this, oh my God, are we going to make it next month? Kind of panic. Then you can be a lot more methodical and probably the people you hire and the culture of the company changes. But right now, what would I say are our tenets? You know, because we are a remote first company, a big one for us is getting people together in person a couple times a year. And it just makes, you know, digital communications, whether it be, you know, a teleconference or a phone call or a Slack or an email, text message, whatever it is, it makes those a little bit easier when you know the person, you know their mannerisms, like, is this person being a jerk or are they just trying to be funny? I don't know, you know, until I know like their facial expressions or kind of their style of communication. And so, you know, I think trying to get people together, even though we're remote, getting people together, that is something we do pretty regularly and I think works well for us. You know, another one is in selection. We want to hire the smartest people, but not if that means hiring someone who, you know, has no intellectual humility. You know, it's and I mean, people have published articles about it forever. You can't have the brilliant jerk. They're toxic. I think we have found that to be true for the most part. Everybody at FreightWaves is the smartest person at something, and they will get absolutely schooled by somebody else in another subject. And that's the way it should be. That's okay. And it's good that everybody knows that here is the subject matter where I'm the expert. And then, you know, what I tell people all the time is, hey, here's my opinion. I am flexible in my opinion. Please tell me I'm wrong. It's the only way I get smarter. And so, you know, having that attitude is something that we reinforce. I think from our leadership down to our, you know, our seniors and lead developers, you know, kind of have that same ethos of, I would rather you ask a question than look cool by not asking questions. It is more important that you get smart than you convince everybody you're smart. I think that's something we tell everybody on their first day of orientation, like ask dumb questions. Nobody's going to look at you sideways because you asked a rookie question. But if we get to crunch time and the major release is coming out, and then we sort of realize, hey, you didn't know what we were talking about for the last 6 months. You know, that can be problematic. And so checking egos at the door is a big one for our culture. I think it should be in everybody's culture, but, you know, I have witnessed hard sales culture and pure ego cultures as well. And, yeah, you know, there's some companies that make it work. It's not for me.
Yeah. So as you are a remote first organization where I assume your employees must be located in various part of the country, various part of the world. So how you manage this wide diversity of people situated in various different locations? And how do you manage and measure the productivity?
Yeah, great question. So it's certainly a challenge, especially around meetings. You know, when we need multiple people to be there, and you do have to think about time zones. You know, we had a new project manager come in, and they were scheduling 9 a.m. Eastern meetings for the people who are on the West Coast, and that's, you know, it's a little early for them. So. So certainly time zones are a challenge around meetings, but you know, really, if you design your kind of software development life cycle such that people can work asynchronously, you know, then it's not as big of an issue. And so then meetings become really the only thing where you have to think about time zones. You know, we've used a number of different project management tools. Right now we're using Jira, but in the past we've used Trello because it was free. We've used ClickUp was good. And so, you know, a good project management tool, but then also kind of an agreement on this is how we shall use the tool. You know, when it goes to this status, it is engineering's job to put on an estimate. Product cannot advance it. They cannot put it in a sprint until engineering has put in a number of hours or points or whatever estimate. And so, having the right systems in place to help you kind of manage work queues, and then having the right kind of rule set or protocol or policy procedures in place to kind of enable asynchronous work is huge for a remote organization. And then earlier, of course, we talked about being able to monitor, are people improving over time? Are they taking on more story points over time? And maybe the answer is no. Maybe the answer is, well, we're not doing a good job of collecting that because, you know, if it's under an hour, just do it. And so, you do have to focus on tool sets and measurability and kind of, protocols that will help you do that asynchronous work. That's key for a remote organization for sure.
Great. Sounds interesting. So now moving to a very interesting part of the question, which many audience, likes listening to. We call it war story as well. So what is your war story? Or is there any challenge you're facing right now which you want to share with the audience?
War story. So, I think war stories are, what are a couple of good ones? So we have, we pull in data from about 200 different sources, via FTP. We go get it from an API. In some cases, we go to a government website and just download a file that they keep changing the name and the format on. Some people FTP stuff to us. Sometimes we go get it from, for straight into somebody's database directly. Just that many processes, that many different partners, something always breaks. Routinely companies change their file format, just never warn you. And so then it causes an outage for us. And then you've got to go talk to customers. Yes, yeah, I know. We're really sorry. We're taking it very seriously, our customers. Then you hang that phone up. You pick the phone right back up and you call your vendor and go, what are you doing? You're killing me here, man. It's kind of always a challenge to be this data intermediary and to have this two-sided marketplace for, that's been a challenge. And then, the other challenge is always infrastructure costs. So your cloud bill goes up every single month. And then periodically we have to go, crap, we got to find some savings. And so we go through and go, okay, is there data that maybe we are archiving in instantly ready storage that maybe we could downgrade to a lower tier of maybe glacial storage or archive storage where they might have a 3-day downtime. Really this is 4-year-old data. I've already got it in my database. I don't need the original file kept, in like instant ready triple backup uptime. And so, I would say we fight fires and have war stories around kind of that ever increasing cloud costs, and then also just around our data providers fail, which then makes us fail to our customers. And you have to be the apologetic vendor on one side and the angry customer on the other side. those are always an adventure. Yeah, but it does happen to us at least once a quarter.
Sure. Great. So now moving to my last part of this conversation. So Daniel, what do you the last piece of advice you want to give to CTOs who is running their team at larger scale or maybe smaller scale, or maybe they are, wanted to get into this role. So what is your advice for this?
I'm always going to, my first thought is going to be the people. If you focus on the people, who make you successful, they will continue to make you successful. The hardest thing as you take higher and higher levels of leadership. In many cases, leadership is earned by being one of the highest performing individual contributors. And that transition is really, really hard to let go of that thing you're so good at. And say, you know what? I have four people who can do it, 75% as well as I can. but they do it, you know, in about 150% as much time, you know, and any, you know, one of these people, maybe you can do one person's job better than them, but you can't do 20 people's job better than 20 people. It's just not realistic. And so, you know, I think as a leader, it's sometimes, especially early in the leadership roles, it's hard to let go of the work that you're so good at and really enjoy. But I think you've got to let go of that, and you've got to focus on the people. If you take care of the people, they will take care of the business. You know, but you've got to, you know, think about career plans for them. You've got to listen to what they're doing, have regular one-on-ones, you know their wife and their kids and their hobbies and their pets' names, and, you know, really get into understanding them. They will take care of the business. They absolutely will. And, you know, be transparent with them and communicate with them how the business is doing and when, you know, there's some challenging, times ahead and when things are going really well, when, you know, be the biggest cheerleader when something that we did results in good business outcomes. That gets everybody riled up. And so, yeah, as a leader for me, all about the people.
That's great. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Daniel. And that brings us to the end of today's episode with Daniel Pickett, CTO of FreightWaves. We hope you enjoyed this insightful conversation about the world of logistic and digital transformation and ChatGPT and organization culture and many other interesting things. So, and to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Stay tuned for more exciting episode. And until next time, keep innovating and embracing the power of technology. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.